My guests today are from the Arcadia Winds and Ensemble des Amis, amateur players who are very well trained and play for the love of it and like to present concerts for the public. And one of them is coming up on Friday night at the Ladies Library. Also here from the Ladies Library, we have a representative, Paula Jameson, and musicians Ron Chase and Barbara Hong. Welcome to you all on this blustery morning. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you.
It's good to be here.
You forgot to introduce yourself, Kara.
Thanks, Barbara. I'm Kara Lawrence. And with that out of the way, let's get into the program for this concert and maybe take a little bit of an overview. Ron, would you talk about the season that you put together as member of the Arcadia Winds?
Be glad to. There are four concerts scheduled for this year, and we had our first one last November. The second one is coming up tomorrow night, and if anybody has been used to arriving at 8 o'clock for the concerts, we are switching that to 7:30 for the remainder of the season. Gives people a little more time afterwards to kind of enjoy themselves or go home and go to bed or something like that. So we want to start a little bit earlier from now on, 7:30.
Actually, that's in line with other concert series in town
this
season.
Yes, that seems to be the case, yes. The concert we're going to have tomorrow night is going to be pretty much the Arcadia Quintet with Barbara Hong on piano. And we are doing three different things. Mike Petkus, our wonderful clarinetist, is going to be performing with Barbara a romance by Richard Strauss. The clarinet part is Strauss's part. The part that Barbara's playing is actually a piano reduction of the orchestral score. It's a very lovely piece and lasts about 6 or 7 minutes or so. Now we're going to be following that with a wind sextet, Barbara on piano again with the full Arcadia Quintet. And for that one, we're going to be doing the Gordon Jacob sextet for piano and winds, which we can talk about a little bit later. It's got a very interesting history to it. Mm. And then the third piece we're doing is a Rimsky-Korsakov piano wind quintet, which also has a very interesting history to it. And then our next concert is going to be on March 17th. There's going to be a series of little solo or duo type things. We're going to be doing a double violin piece by Bach, and we're going to be joined by the Arioso Trio, as a matter of fact, who will be guest performers. We'll be doing that, and we'll also be doing a bassoon concerto, or sonata, I should say, by Saint-Saëns. Played by Judy Belland, our bassoonist, and there's one other work. I can't remember. Leo Schmidt, a Dutch composer. We're going to be doing his piano wind sextet, a very wonderful piece that I don't think is performed very often, but it's absolutely wonderful. And then the fourth one in May, we will have a wind octet by Stravinsky. We will have, I hope, a shortened version of the opera Quiet City. There's a short piece written by Aaron Copland. And we're going to do what I hope is going to be the full orchestral score using 15 players of the Brahms Second Serenade.
Mm. I'd like to talk a little bit about why you perform in public. What made you, after finding people to play with and having some satisfying run-throughs and reading sessions, why you decided to create a concert series?
Well, we all love music, and we all love it so much that we work on it kind of on a daily basis, as a matter of fact. I enjoy practicing, and I think everybody else does too, otherwise we wouldn't be here. When we practice, we'd like to have something to practice for. We'd like to share, you know, what we're actually practicing. It'd be kind of sad to just simply internally sit inside your house and do things that are really quite nice and a lot of fun and then not go out and project them anywhere. You know, so we go out and we perform. And in the case of the Arcadia Quintet, it started out as a nucleus from the Kalamazoo Philharmonia Orchestra. I had decided that I wanted to play in a quintet, and Mike Petkus encouraged me to find other players, and that's basically how we expanded out into a quintet. So we're amateurs, and we love to play, and we love to share what we do.
Thanks, Ron. Now, Paula, you've been associated with the Ladies' Library downtown for a long time. It's this beautiful two-story house looking. It's not exactly like an office building or anything. Like it has.
Many people have thought it was an old mansion, in fact.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Does it have a personality to you? Is it something that asks you to be filled with people and used as a concert hall?
I think so. A lot of us have taken to calling it the Grand Lady because it is, there's something very feminine about the place. It was the first building in the United States that was actually financed and built by a women's organization in 1878, 1879. So we have kind of pride of historical place among achievements for women around the country. And the organization had been founded in 1852 to provide the community with a library. There had been no libraries in Southwest Michigan at all. And in those days, the kind of federal encouragement was not for what we now know as public libraries, but for as membership libraries. And so people would pay us in those days a fairly small fee, the cost of a book maybe, which might have been 50 cents, a dollar. And then they got borrowing privileges. And over time, even before the building was built, the women had amassed a collection of about 3,500 books and had, I think at the peak, about 700 subscribers around the community. Men could be subscribers as well as women, although women were the ones that ran the place, which was also kind of interesting. And over time, they decided to build the building and were given the property by a member and sent off to Chicago for architectural drawings. And the style is called Venetian Gothic, which is a very grand Victorian style that was used for public buildings, not so much for homes. And so if you drive down South Park Street as you're approaching Bronson Park and the Civic Theater, it's this rather lovely orangey-red building with these white stripes of limestone and a peaked roof and gables and stained glass. It's quite magical.
Interesting to think of it standing alone without the Civic next door or the KIA or across the street, the Parish Theater, but alone in a sort of a park-like setting.
It was in a residential area at that point. The old engravings show houses on either side.
Oh, okay. So it was part of the neighborhood.
It was part of a neighborhood, although the ladies were a little reluctant, apparently, in those days to accept the gift of the property because they felt it was too central and it was going to be noisy. The streets hadn't yet been paved. It was muddy. There was a lot of traffic. And it was actually a little prescient because there was no real way of knowing that that part of downtown was going to remain as vibrant as it has.
Was Bronson Park also there?
The park, I think, was there from almost the very first. That was part of the deed to the city was that this was going to be for public buildings. So it's surrounded by churches and City Hall and the Civic Theater. It was never intended to be the center of a business district the way the further east and downtown was.
We've talked before about recent updates. An elevator has been installed, allowing people to get to the second floor concert hall. Could you remind us how many people can fit into the upstairs concert hall?
The upstairs concert hall is very intimate, is my nice way of putting it. We only can seat 79 people, so it's perfect for chamber music. Mm-hmm. And about 2 years ago, we were able to purchase new, comfortable seating that is in harmony with the look of the hall. Before, we had these beautiful but very uncomfortable caned chairs. So it's a lot nicer for the audience now, too.
And you've attended these concerts before.
Yes, many of them, yes.
Now, you're probably friends with members of the Arcadia Quintet at this point.
I hope so.
Certainly.
I'm certainly a fan and supporter, so.
Well, let's look at the second work on the program. We've heard about the fact that it opens with a Strauss romance for clarinet and piano. Mike Petkus and Barbara Hong will be performing that. But then six of you will be on stage to perform a work by Gordon Jacob. That name makes me think of articles by music critics, music appreciators saying, why don't more people play or listen to Gordon Jacob, one of the underrepresented composers of the last century?
Yes. Gordon Jacob was British, born in 1895, and was schooled at the Royal Conservatory and ended up teaching there also, as a matter of fact. And his composing style was kind of a little bit out of step with the norm at that particular time. He was doing most of his composing in the late 1920s and 30s, and actually wrote right up until the 1960s. His music is tonal. It is listenable. Occasionally goes off on little flights of dissonance from time to time to make it interesting. But it is very approachable music, being written at a time when the music was evolving into atonal styles and very intellectual type of composition. So he was kind of looked down upon by other composers of the British style. And so he kind of had to fight against the tide a little bit as he was continuing to compose. And he would write light music. He wrote a fair amount of really good band music.
I was going to ask you, did you ever play the William Byrd Suite in
yes,
band?
Yes. And anyway, that's kind of, I think at least, and I think other people might say the same thing, that's why he didn't quite get quite as famous as some of the other British composers at that time.
What can you tell us about this particular sextet? It's a low opus number, opus 6. Oh, Barbara, why don't you chime in?
This sextet is subtitled, or I believe it's subtitled, In Memoriam to Aubrey Brain, a French horn player and father of maybe even more famous Dennis Brain, who was unfortunately killed in a car accident. And the composer wanted to preserve this memorial by taking the musical letters, letters from the name Aubrey Brain. So the piece is based on these letters as a thematic basis. So it's A, B, E, B, A. And we start off with an elegy to Aubrey Brain, and you hear this melody very clearly. Then the suite moves on to a scherzo, which takes those same letters, but they're now in a fast motion. So if you listen carefully, you can still hear the same melody going through most of the movements.
This is something Shostakovich did at the same time period.
Yes, you're right. Yeah, so this is 1950s, and this is something in the air the composers were doing. Yeah, so there is a second movement scherzo, which is playful. There is a third movement cortege, which is not based on those letters, but is based on a B-flat tonality, and that is a funeral march. To me, it calls up the image of some kind of very solemn state funeral march down some broad avenue with the black hearse and the black horses and the black plumes on their heads and people walking dressed in formal black. It's very heart-wrenching, that funeral march. Then there is a minuet and trio and a rondo that's quite playful that comes back at the end, reminding us of the original elegy and a little bit of the funeral march. So it's constructed of these little melodic bits, but he makes something new and interesting each movement about it.
I'm curious, since this was written for the memory of a horn player, is it the most prominent part, or does it all blend more or less equally? What do you think, Barbara?
I guess I would turn that back to Ron. The horn does have an important part.
The horn has licks here and there, but it basically is pretty much blended with the other instruments and is really, by and large, no more important than the oboe or the clarinet or the flute. It's just maybe the horn is not used to being quite so well treated. And anyway, but it's equal to all the rest of the instruments.
So we'll hear oboe, clarinet, horn, and bassoon?
And flute.
And flute. So the full woodwind quintet.
The full quintet, yes.
Plus piano. And I do have the first movement queued up here.
One little thing I want to add there. In that theme, there is the interval of a fourth, which is quite easy for French horns, and so we have this kind of music that fits the horn very well and is prominent throughout the piece.
This is the Elegiac Prelude, Movement 1 from the Sextet for Piano and Winds, Opus 6 by Gordon Jacob. We've heard the opening movement of the Sextet for Piano and Winds, Opus 6 by Gordon Jacob, the Elegiac Prelude, which is kind of dark. I'm wondering where the piece would go from here, because we have quite a lonely-sounding beginning. Ron, you said that the piece was written in memory of Aubrey Brain.
Yes, it was.
I didn't realize that Dennis Brain's father, Aubrey Brain,
yes,
was also
yes.
a horn player.
And Aubrey himself was quite a virtuoso horn player and principal horn in at least more than one of London's many orchestras back in those days. I think he actually traveled from one orchestra to another and played principal horn, as did his son also eventually. Aubrey was very famous in his day, and he personally taught his son, who became even more famous. As a matter of fact, Dennis is considered by most horn players as probably the finest player in the 20th century, and maybe ever, for that matter.
I wonder why is that? What do you think earns him?
He just absolutely made it flow. I mean, there was just impeccable, absolutely perfect horn playing. The tone was very sweet. It was not heavy. It wasn't a really heavy orchestral tone, but it was a very, very nice tone. Probably his lyrical playing was just absolutely impeccable. It's just unbelievable. All you can say is that there's just absolutely nothing wrong with him. I mean, he's just absolutely great.
I believe a young Neil Saunders, 18, 19 years old, had auditioned and was playing in the London Philharmonic next to Dennis
yes,
Brain.
Yes, they did for a while, for as a while. Matter of fact, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And Neil Saunders went on to end up teaching at Western
right,
Michigan University.
Right. And I actually heard him perform before he even came to Western, when he was with the Melos Ensemble.
the Mellis Ensemble. Again, that's a critical chamber music group in the 20th century that kind of championed chamber music at the time.
Yes.
When did you see the Mellis Ensemble?
Back in 1965, as a matter of fact, when I was teaching at Marshall University in West Virginia, and the Mellis Ensemble was there to perform.
So they were touring in the
right,
60s.
And Neil Saunders did an absolutely wonderful job on the Brahms Horn Trio, as a matter of fact.
That must have filled your heart with
yes,
happiness.
Yes.
Were you playing at that time? Because I know that for part of your career, you put the horn down.
I set it down quite a bit before 1965, as a matter of fact. So I was not playing then, but still very much appreciating it.
Yeah.
And I actually didn't start playing again until 2007.
Just a few years ago. And we've talked about that, too, about how it's possible to do that. Have you found yourself continuing to improve since you picked it up again?
I think so. The confidence is improving, certainly. And along with that, I guess the playing is improving also.
Actually, while we're talking about musical pasts, I should include Barbara Hong on this conversation. You have degrees in music, is it performance and history?
Yes, I have a bachelor's degree and a master's degree in piano performance. And from there, I went into music history. And I finally completed my doctorate degree in between three babies. Yes. And then I taught at Western Michigan University for a bit.
I'm curious to hear about what you consider some of your top concert-going experiences that you can think of, like Ron hearing the Mellis Ensemble and Neil Saunders. Any great pianists that you just would never give up having seen? It looks like almost too many to count, or too
yes,
few.
Yes. I guess you've stuck me there. I think maybe some of the more interesting performances was during my time as a student at Indiana University, where there's an opera every Saturday. And you just walk across campus and go, and there it is. It's just marvelous to be in a place that's so active. Yeah.
So opera.
Opera, yes.
Not solo piano recitals.
Well, we had good solo piano recitals too, yes. Yes. I think the Gilmore is amazing in that regard, that we have everybody coming to us, and that's very impressive. Yes.
The pianist Andras Schiff is set to appear later in the spring.
Yes. That'd be great.
Yeah.
Yes, and I'm particularly looking forward to hearing Cameron Carpenter, organist with the Kalamazoo Symphony. He is, in my opinion, the Liberace of the organ. he does arrangements of things by Chopin where all the fast notes are in the pedal. And he's known for wearing shoes with sequins and such things. It's amazing what he does, just amazing. Yes.
We'll have to. That's on the Kalamazoo Symphony season this spring and Gilmore.
Yes.
But we'll have to remind listeners that we're talking about a concert happening on Friday at 7:30. Barbara Hong, you are serving as the pianist anchoring two major works, the Gordon Jacob Sextet and the Rimsky-Korsakov Quintet. Why don't we hear another movement, maybe a contrasting movement, from this Gordon Jacob Sextet, Opus 6. Is there something you would recommend?
We'd like to recommend the second movement, which is a scherzo.
Okay. Thank you. We've heard the second movement, Scherzo, from the Sextet for Piano and Winds, Opus 6, by Gordon Jacob, which will be heard in full on Friday night. Music begins at 7:30 p.m. at the Ladies' Library in downtown Kalamazoo. My guests here today are Paula Jacobson from the Ladies' Library. Gordon Jacob Jameson. Paula, thank you for correcting me. Ron Chase, horn player, and Barbara Hong, pianist, appearing on the program. Who are the other musicians? Can you list them? Ron?
On flute, we have Bobby Coleman. On oboe, we have Wendy Mazur. Our bassoonist is Judy Belland, and our clarinetist is Mike Petkus.
And how long have you performed together as a quintet?
We formed in the fall of 2009. So this is basically our eighth season right now.
And what is the procedure for choosing programs and deciding what to play between the five of you?
Well, we just have a meeting, usually in August, and we plan a season. And each person throws into the hat things that they would like to do, and we hash it around a little bit, and we agree on a program, and we start the season. And the program does change a little bit as we go along from time to time, but we're just a very compatible group, and we pretty much agree with what each other wants to do, and we go ahead with it.
And the program and the season ends up being four concerts spread throughout the year, and all at the. It's always been at the Ladies' Library. Have you performed elsewhere?
They've always been at the Ladies' Library. For the first 2 years we did this, we only had three concerts, and this is the first year we've expanded to four.
You were saying during the music that you love playing at the Ladies' Library because a lot of the music you play is sort of concurrent with. The time the building was constructed.
And I think of that particularly when we are doing the Rimsky-Korsakov. And of course, Richard Strauss was alive when the building was being built also. But Rimsky-Korsakov in particular kind of sticks in my head. And every time I walk in the back door and go up the elevator, I think to myself, you know, I'm walking into a building that Rimsky-Korsakov himself could have stood outside and watched being built. And it just adds a little bit of extra dimension to what we're doing.
A Russian in Kalamazoo. Rimsky-Korsakov, he's not known for chamber music at all. He's known for the huge tone poem, Scheherazade, maybe some other big orchestral pieces and arrangements. What are the circumstances of this quintet for piano and winds?
Well, this is kind of an interesting story. Rimsky-Korsakov started pretty much composing on his own when he was quite young. And he was half-hearted about it because he has a dual love for the sea. And he couldn't decide in his early days whether he wanted to be a musician or a sailor. And he started out being the latter. And then for a while he combined the two. But at any rate, he also was interested in composing and made very good friends with another existing Russian composer, Emily Balakirov, who actually guided him in some of his early days of composition. And so he just took off on his own and learned how to compose and took piano lessons and learned music.
How far did he get in the Navy?
Well, he actually got commissioned. He went on almost a three-year cruise, and actually composed during the down moments while he was on shipboard, as a matter of fact, and then came back and eventually ended up at the St. Petersburg Conservatory. But at any rate, the piano wind quintet was written in his early life during this time when he was being kind of guided along and was composing without really any what you might call formal conservatory education. And he set it aside, and he did other things for a while. And then there was a Russian music competition where new composers were being judged. You know, they each one would submit a composition or more than one in his case. And they would be judged, and there would be a prize for it. And he put this piece, his early composition, into the competition along with another piece. And he was absolutely convinced that he would win with the quintet. I mean, he was just walked in there assuming that he was the winner. And it turned out that the musicians that the competition people arranged to play it were not very good. The pianist was particularly bad, as a matter of fact. And the end result was it didn't come off at all. And Rimsky-Korsakov not only didn't win it, but he didn't even get an honorable mention. And he was absolutely furious, and he went back and demanded that the competition be run all over again so that he could get a fair shake, which, of course, they didn't do. And so he just in a sense, took the piece and threw it in the closet at home, and it stayed there. And it wasn't discovered until after his death, and then it was published 3 years after his death.
Yeah. It says Opus Posthumus here, yeah.
Yes.
So it was a very early work, but he, for resentful reasons perhaps, just let it sit in his closet.
Yes.
Well, I for one find it an incredibly tuneful piece. Is this something that a lot of wind players are actually aware of, or was it just one of you who knew of the piece?
The wind community is aware of it. I'm not really sure how often it's performed. I learned it at a workshop back several years ago, and I have not heard anybody mentioned up until this year hearing it or playing it. And it's a favorite of our clarinetist, Mike Petkus. He really likes it. Mm-hmm. And so he encouraged its performance, and here we are.
So you found a sextet for piano and winds by Gordon Jacob and this quintet for piano and winds by Rimsky-Korsakov. What other famous composers have written for this combination that you can think of?
Just a wind quintet instead of a sextet?
With four winds plus piano.
Okay, well, there's the famous Mozart quintet and the Beethoven quintet.
Mozart and Beethoven did
right.
this.
They did. And I'm not really, right off the top of my head, I can't recall any others. I'm sure they're out there, but I don't remember.
Well, I'm in the same boat with you, Ron. It's Mozart, Beethoven, and then Rimsky-Korsakov? Why? Maybe he was actually, as a student, going through combinations of chamber music like that and came across the Mozart and Beethoven.
Well, he very carefully studied Berlioz's orchestration techniques, and he may actually have been thinking about it as an experimental composition.
Well, let's hear the first movement of this lovely quintet for piano and winds by Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov. With which player is sitting out after?
The oboe.
The oboe is sitting out. Okay, we'll hear a recording from the Naxos label, or rather the BIS label, music of Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, opening movement. what should have been a composition-winning, prize-winning piece for Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov turned out to be a huge disappointment when the first performance in front of the judges was butchered. This is according to the story told by Ron Chase, horn player of Arcadia Winds, and he's here along with pianist Barbara Hong and Paula Jameson from the Ladies' Library. And Barbara, you have some sympathy for those musicians who were probably sight-reading all of the compositions that day.
It's hard to imagine a committee appointing the musicians to play a piece and then giving them a week or so to play this thing. The final movement of this work has cadenzas for each instrument. It has an episode in the rondo, which is a fugue for piano alone. And there's so much virtuosity that you can well imagine that even the musicians threw up their hands and said, oh, we just, you know, so you could very well understand why Rimsky-Korsakov was so terribly disappointed.
Because the pitfalls
really
are
angered,
right there in the piece.
Yes.
Well, I'm really glad we have a revival happening this Friday, tomorrow, at the Ladies' Library of the Rimsky-Korsakov, at Plus Music of Gordon, Jacob, and Richard Strauss. We're at the end of our hour here, so I would just ask for any final thoughts on, since you're on the microphone, Barbara.
My clarinet colleague plays so beautifully and so wonderfully. We have an ongoing joke that in the, 12 years that we have performed and played together, I've heard him play maybe two wrong notes.
It's hard for Mike Petticus to do wrong.
He's a wonderful clarinetist.
Let's hear from Ron.
I guess my parting comment is that our experience has been that the hall itself sounds better and better with more and more people in it. So if you want to actually contribute your own self to some wonderful music, come in and help us with the acoustics.
I forgot to mention this earlier in the hour, but listeners will want to know if this is a ticketed event or not.
It is free.
It is free.
We do hope that there is a donation, but the performances are free.
Okay. And Paula, is there anything a listener should know as well?
Well, since the concert time is now 7:30, I would encourage people to come a bit early. Doors will open at 7. The Ladies' Library does have a parking lot across Lovell Street on the south side, but these parking lots are all fair game in the evening, so I'd encourage you to come early. And after the concert, there will be a reception with an opportunity to share some tea and cookies and talk to the musicians. So hope you can come.
Well, thank you, Paula, Ron, and Barbara. It's nice to have you here once again, and we'll see you in a month or two.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Final movement of the Rimsky-Korsakov will take us to 11 o'clock and news from NPR.